Hello, and welcome to the Midwest Genealogy Center's Tell Me a Story program, an initiative to record America's family history in sound. Oral histories are one of the most personal and rewarding ways to preserve family stories. The Tell Me a Story sessions are 45-minute interviews between two people with the assistance of a trained facilitator. Participants will receive a compact disc with the full interview. A copy will be archived at the Midwest Genealogy Center and, with permission, later made available to the public. And now, another story.
Good morning. This is Melanie Nelson, a volunteer for the Midwest Genealogy Society, where today, on September 10th, 2016, the Mid-Continent Public Library's annual Veterans Salute marks the 25th anniversary of the Gulf War. I have the distinct pleasure to conduct an oral interview with U.S. Army retired Sergeant First Class Gary Kropp. Let's start, if you would, by stating your full name and describe for us what you did in the service.
My name is Gary L. Kropp. I joined the Army pretty quick, and my recruiter told me I was out of my mind. Being the cook in the service was one of the worst jobs you want, because you start early in the morning and you never stop until you get done. Mm-hmm. So I joined the service, and it was when I was 17, because I was pretty young, and I said, okay, fine, here we go. So I joined the Army in 1983, and then July 14th, I was basic training. So less than 2 months, you know, I was back in getting used to what the military life was all about, because my dad and my brothers ahead of me, and they were all in the service too. So it's not like we were following each other. It was just that our dad said, you can do what you want to, and you can do what you want to, and do any job you want to, just as long as you finish it, and if you're happy with it, then we'll support you. And that's what my parents were all about. My mom never stopped us from joining the service. She says it was the best thing for every one of us to go through, and we made the best of it.
So when you were 17, you knew then you wanted to be an Army cook?
Actually, I didn't know I really wanted to be an Army cook, but I was already a cook prior to that, because that was one of my loves and passion, food. Mm-hmm. And so I just had the niche of this is what I really wanted to do. So as I joined the service, my recruiter said, you have one of two options. You can do whatever these other guys want you to do, do what you want to do, but what do you want to do? I said, I want to be a cook. And he says, you're out of your mind. That's exactly what he told me. He says, that's the worst job you can be in the service. I said, okay, fine. I'll prove you wrong.
So you mentioned you went through basic training. Mm-hmm. And then what happened? Where did you go? Where was your first station?
Fort Lee, Virginia, Army Cooking School, quartermaster school, where they teach all the cooks to learn how to do the basics for the service. And when I got to Fort Lee, Virginia, I was so well advanced among everybody else, I finished early. So they had a program, what they called culinary arts, which is chef's training. Mm-hmm. So I got involved in that, finished that, and then they said, okay, well, they choose 22 soldiers a year out of the program to go to chef school. So I have the distinction of being one of those 22 to get chosen to go to chef school. So after I finished my training at Fort Lee, they sent me to chef school in Chicago, which was the Army paid for. Mm-hmm. So I did 16 months there and finished, and then my first assignment was in Germany. So they sent me to a armor unit, tanker unit, mm-hmm. in Germany. Mm-hmm. So when I finished my tour over there, I traced my ancestors while I was over in Germany, so it was pretty cool.
What'd you find out?
Well, I found out my grandfather was a Nazi.
Oh.
He was actually forced into it, because both sides of my family, the Speck name and the Kropp name, are all German, and we traced both of them down just about 50 miles from where I was stationed at the first time. So we chased in all these little tiny towns and found out that my grandfather was a Nazi because he was forced into it. At that time, is either you become one or they kill your entire family. They didn't care.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Mm-hmm.
So that was something that was totally different. And then when I left Germany, I finished on top as one of the best cooks in the Army in mm-hmm. Germany. So mm-hmm. I got chosen for the U.S. Army Culinary Arts Team mm-hmm. To compete in competitions. So I got involved in that, where I went to all the cooking classes and enhanced my training to become a chef.
So tell us a little bit about the competitions.
Well, the competitions are just like what you see on TV, where they have chefs from all over the country and compete on these levels of expertise. So if you do pastries, or you do foods, or you do cold buffet desserts, or an entire dinner plating, you compete against other chefs from across the country. And all these people that was in Germany were all Army cooks. And they all had their own team, so you competed against their own mm-hmm. people in the mm-hmm. service. Mm-hmm. And people were like, oh, cooking is terrible in the Army. Mm-hmm. Not from where I came from, it wasn't pretty bad.
So what was your specialty?
Pastries. Mm. And Italian cooking.
So what's it like to cook for a large armor unit in Germany?
It depended on where you was at. Most of the time we were in the field, so we had our own little mobile kitchen trailers. So we were on Taunus Mountains in Germany, sometimes 10 feet of snow, and it's cold and you can't get nothing going. It's so cold that it gels the fuel in the trucks. Yeah, but my job was, because I always had heat, there was always coffee, hot chocolate, soup. Yeah. And to keep the morale up, you had to do whatever it had to take to feed these guys. And hot chow in the middle of the 30-degree temperatures and 10 feet of snow was pretty enticing to these guys to do their job.
Tell us about a time where you had to be extremely creative to put together a meal that kept the troops' morale up.
I think the most creative was when we was in Desert Shield under the storm. Mm-hmm. They dropped us in the middle of the desert, sandstorm going around.
What time frame?
I think it was March of 91, mm-hmm. and they brought us all our stuff in refrigeration trucks. They airlifted it mm-hmm. into us in the middle of the desert and said, we have 20,000 soldiers coming, and we need you to get everybody ready to cook for all these people for a Thanksgiving meal.
Wow.
It was in the middle of the desert. They were just coming in droves, and we had these trailers just made like a large kitchen. These guys did the pastries. These guys did the turkeys and hams. Another guy did the mashed potatoes and rolls. We put it all together in the middle of a sandstorm and nobody got sick.
Wow.
Not one.
Wow.
How many people did you feed?
38,000, I think, was the total in about 9.5 hours.
Wow. That's amazing.
But I also had almost 500 cooks doing this around shift just to keep things going, so it was pretty spectacular.
So it sounds like there's a lot that happens between Germany and Desert Storm. Mm-hmm. What happens after Germany, after you go to Chicago for chef school?
I got stationed in Korea. And then I left Korea. Didn't like it. Just did my job and just came home.
What was it about Korea that you didn't?
It was the atmosphere where I was stationed. I was a DMZ, so I wasn't mm-hmm. able to go out and do sightseeing like in Seoul, Korea, and go see the countryside. I wasn't able to go anywhere. Mm-hmm. And I was stuck the DMZ watching these sentries that could pick you off any time, but you can't fire back at them. Mm-hmm. And it was just tensions in 84 were pretty tough. Mm-hmm. As soon as I left Korea, I got stationed in Fort Stewart, Georgia. Loved it. Mm-hmm. But as soon as I got there, they shipped me out to Egypt for 6 months. called Bright Star 85. And so we went to Egypt when everything was calm and quiet. Mm-hmm. Got to cook on a beach for all these NATO forces right there on the mm-hmm. Mediterranean Sea, which mm-hmm. was awesome. And then I came back after I did my tour over there. I got involved in the culinary arts again and got chosen for Fort Lee to become an instructor. But I turned it down because there was a pretty stiff competition. So I liked where I was at, and then because I turned the job down, a four-star general came down during the competition and said, how would you like to be my personal cook?
Nice.
So this was the chairman of Joint Chief Staff's office. So it was the vice chief of staff of the U.S. Mm-hmm. Army. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, you're choosing a sergeant to be your own personal cook.
Remember his name?
General Maxwell Thurman. Mm-hmm. He's no longer alive, but he was a single 4-star general. Mm-hmm. Was never married, had mm-hmm. no kids. Mm-hmm. He was just...
How do you think he found out about you?
I think he was part of the judging the competition because mm-hmm. he was part of the U.S. Army Food Quartermaster Corps. Mm-hmm. So he came down and judged part of the competition and seen what he had to choose mm-hmm. from. Mm-hmm. And just happened to be he chose me. So I said, sure, I'll do it. I said, okay, for the next 18 months, you're going to be assigned to the Pentagon for the Chairman Joint Chief Staff's office. I'm like, okay. No problem. Got up there. My job really didn't exist because all I was doing was taking care of the general. So I didn't have no job for the Army cooking. So I'm like, okay, what do I do now? So I had a PT program that was consist of playing tennis with the old man in the afternoon. That was the PT program for 2 years.
Yeah.
Make sure he wins. No problem. So I did that, and while I was in Washington, D.C., I worked for the, what they call Wainwright Hall, for 6 months where all the officers come in before they get their assignments. Mm-hmm. So you cater to their needs as a manager for mm-hmm. this building. So I did that job, mm-hmm. and I said, okay, fine. You got 6 months to do. What do you want left? Mm-hmm. Well, what's there to do? So I decided to go and become a chef at the Fort Myers Officers Club. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I got hired there by the retired Command Sergeant Major to be his maitre d' and everything involved in the dining room. So I said, okay, I'll take the job. Mm-hmm. So I did that, and then I also got to be working at the White House to help them become part of the cooking staff for the last 6 months of my tour in Washington, D.C.
And who was sitting in the White House at that time?
President Ronald Reagan. At that time. Okay. And when my assignment ended, I said, okay, where are you sending me? Oh, we're sending you back to Germany. I said, cool. So I got left Washington, D.C., got stationed in Germany and field artillery unit.
Mm-hmm. What year was that?
1986 through 87. And then I got stationed after that. I came back to Fort Campbell, Kentucky. So I went from a field artillery unit in Germany to the 101st Airborne Unit and became part of the mess sergeant team for the largest dime facility on post for 5 years. And at that time, we had 372 cooks feeding 26,000 meals a day, 24 hours a day. Our building never closed.
Wow.
So if you wanted a hamburger and hot dogs and fries at 2 o'clock in the morning when these guys go out and party, they can come back, sign their name on the dotted line, and have a meal.
Yeah.
And starting at 4:30, we had breakfast, and you had 2 hours to feed 5,000 people. Mm. And our dining rooms were so big that you fit 2 dining rooms, 3,000 people at the dinner table at one time on both dining rooms.
Wow.
And you're constantly moving things. As soon as lunch was done, you're already cooking dinner. And it just goes on and on and on. And at nighttime, my guys prepared probably 20,000 servings of pastry. And they did everything homemade.
Mm.
Wow.
From pies to cakes to cookies.
Mm-hmm.
And it was... And then Desert Shield came along.
And so you deployed to Desert Shield and
two weeks,
Fort Campbell?
Yep. 2 weeks after they invaded Kuwait, we was already sitting in Saudi.
Mm-hmm.
On in the desert for 15 months,
mm-hmm.
and then we got to go across the border, not fire nothing, didn't fire a shot.
Across the border to?
Into Iraq, and then through the oil well fires and swimming in the oil and everything else. And that was pretty nasty. And then it was all over. Time to come home. But
tell them about the time you got hurt, the two times you got hurt.
Well, that was later on in my reserve time.
Oh,
I left active duty to become a reservist, and then I did recruiting in Houston for 2 years, and then I joined the reserves in Iowa, Combat Engineer Unit, Combat Service Hospital, and the Quartermaster Supply Company. With those three reserve units, I ended up in Iraq two different times.
Okay.
First time was a cash hospital and a quartermaster supply company. The cash hospital was the worst for me to see all the carnage of war. And it was pretty tough what you had to go through at that point. And for me, the worst for me was a young lady. She was 26 years old. She, her job was just running the welfare tent, MWR tents, they call it. And she had stepped out, and she got hit by a mortar. We got hit in July with a bunch of mortars. She got hit. I got blown back in the building. And I stayed with her because I was the closest to her, because I was also, besides being the food service operations sergeant of the entire operation in and around Baghdad, I was also a combat lifesaver. So you actually learn as you go along to take care of people besides doing your job. Well, I was the closest one to her, and she got hit severely. Her spinal column and brain was exposed, where the hinge was laid open. So, best sum it up, she was still alive when we got to her. I stayed with her the entire time in the hospital, in the ambulance, waiting on the medevac helicopter. And she started leaking, so I changed her bandage, and she took her last breath and emptied in my lap. She was only 26 years old. So that was the worst for me. And then my second tour finished off where I was had no job again, so I was part of what they call the warlock team. Warlock team is you go out, hunt the IEDs. You mark them for the EOD guys to dismantle them so the soldiers stay safe. We had a device on the truck to jam the frequency from exploding. Well, I got hit the first time during the mission as part of the warlock team doing the convoy mission. I got shot twice, and didn't even know I got shot until after everything was done, the mission. And then I collapsed. And that's when I fell out in the desert. The guy came over and looked at me and says, "Oh my gosh." Opened up my vest, two slugs came out. Dropped to the ground. Didn't penetrate the skin, but what it did, the internal injuries I had, broken ribs, punctured lung.
Wow.
It looks like somebody just took a baseball bat and just beat you up. But the vest saved my life. 45 days in the hospital, got cleared.
Where were you in the hospital? There, or did they back you?
In Balad.
Oh, Balad, okay.
Because only 45 days. All they did was just, they came up through my artery and my leg and sewed me up from the inside. Perfect. Didn't open me up, didn't do nothing. So medical advancements, perfect. So I got cleared to go back and do the same job again. And 63 days later, I had a friend of mine, we did the mission, and it was 9:30 at night. It was 2 miles from the base when we hit the roadside bomb. Launched us up in the air 20 feet. Everything that you see in the movie just like freezes and you can see the particles and everything, and then it stops. Mm-hmm. Well, that was real. And then when it came down to Earth, it split the truck in two pieces. Well, it folded me like a sandwich in the seat. The guy next to me, he got a traumatic brain injury where it rotated his skull, in his brain, the side of his skull, disconnected all his wiring, turned him into a marshmallow.
Oh, gosh.
Well, we didn't know how bad we were hurt, but we were lucky to be alive. Because usually when they roadside bomb, it disables you, they come back with small arms fires and they kill you. They just spray you with bullets and they leave. Well, never happened. My radio was still intact, so I called. Within 5 minutes, the Marines came and got us and took us to the hospital. Well, they didn't know that I had a broken back. All they cared about was getting us out of the truck and getting us the medical attention. And that's when I found out later that I had broken my back down here, just by my waist. Yeah. So, and then I came back home, and now I work for a medical supply company, and I work for the VA department.
So the incidents that you were that you just shared, when were those? Were those in the
Iraq OIF 1 and OIF 2.
Okay. So you had both experiences of OIF 1 and 2.
Uh-huh. Yep. And then in between, I also had humanitarian missions to go to Panama, Saudi, Bosnia, and then did government cleanup when we had tornado damage in Iowa. Our reserve unit was called up to clean up the town, and I got awarded for that too. So, so it wasn't all bad, but it was something that I'll never forget.
It sounds like your job dramatically changed when you moved from active duty over to the reserves.
Yes.
How did that happen? How did that work out?
Well, it was because of our wonderful government. They had all these contractors that they would shove on to somebody else because these guys trained as water purification guys, cooks and everything else. So KBR took over those contracts. And what that happened is the soldiers had to become soldiers. And they had to don weapons and they had to go out there and learn how to do actual fighting.
Did you feel like you almost had to start at square one again, or did your active duty help prepare you for your reserve time?
Yeah, actually, it doesn't prepare you to do anything because it depends on your unit. Our units were all people that we knew each other in and around our community. So you prepared your job, whether it was humanitarian missions or going out and building roads for your local community or helping people rebuild their houses and do community projects, you knew each other. So you were actually a tighter-knit group. But then when it come to OIF 1, OIF 2, and so on, they brought in soldiers from across the country to fill in the gaps. So you didn't know actually who you were going to get. And then you had to train these people for the first time going over in combat. And 90% of the soldiers in reservists and National Guard never seen combat.
If you could talk and give advice to your 17-year-old self, what would you tell that person now?
Well, I'd do what my dad told me. He says, don't let anybody tell you you can't do anything until you try and give it a shot. And then if you try and you do the best of what you do, you've succeeded whether you win or lose. That's what my dad taught me.
Wise man.
Yeah, because in 2004, I got called up from my second tour. My dad sat across from me and started crying. He is a veteran from Korea and Vietnam. And I've never seen my dad cry before because he said he didn't think, because he knew how bad it was going to get over there. He says, I don't think you're ever coming back. And this is your own dad sitting there going like, oh my gosh.
Right.
And I freaked out. And I'm like, Dad, don't worry. I will be back.
Yeah.
I made it back just in time for him because he was dying of cancer. And I made it back in time. So that's what I would tell on these kids today. The service is not all bad. It's just what you make of it. You do your 2 years, you take what the government gives you, get your education, and you go forward. But as long as you do your 2 years, you've committed yourself to our government and our country.
And you retired when?
2005.
Was your expectation of going in to become a cook, how was that expectation realized? And did you end up, was it more than you thought you'd ever achieve?
Yeah, because I have so many awards that prove that. But you never expect, growing up on a farm in Illinois, that you end up going into service and actually retiring and succeeded along the way. I mean, going from just a regular education from high school, farm boy, to cooking at the White House. How many people get to do that?
Right.
Not very many. And for my expectations, it was awesome. So I never regretted every bit. So.
Well, we'll wrap up here. Thank you very much for spending some of your time today with us.
Yes, that's quite a story.
And thank you for your service.
Thank you.
We very much appreciate that.
Thanks.